profound concern that only those who know the Lord Jesus Christ should join the church, and especially should become office bearers in it. If I know anything about you men, it is this is your profound concern that only those who know the Lord should be in the congregation, and it is a cause of thanksgiving to some of us who have been on the way many years that we could say that practically the whole of our congregations are in that state as far as we can know human nature. Then also this other thing, the state of the body. Certainly as far as this company is concerned, from the very beginning we have taken a very great deal of interest in one another. There's a communication between us, exchanging magazines, telephone messages, writing, prayer concern. If you heard in some of the prayer meetings in the Church of Scotland, the prayer, free churches, and all the Church of Scotland, naming men, lists of men running around Scotland praying, there is a profound concern for one another within the body. Then disengagement was a rather negative word to use for so many who are doubtless not as engaged. You maybe hear George Philip in this in a moment, and this is a great point with him, that we're not involved sufficiently in the courts of the church and so on. But disengagement was a fairly hard word of you to use, I thought. One other thing more. From the very beginning of this, whatever we call ourselves, I call it a brotherhood because I think it's a nice Christian loving word. Almost the inception, certainly from the time that Frank Lyle, our lawman, came into the thing, it has been far from unthinkable for us that one day we might either be thrown out or walk out. In fact, when Frank Lyle gave his inaugural lecture as a professor in Aberdeen Public Law, and some of the Faculty of Divinity were there, he practically said that he believed the day might come when we would have to leave. So that is in our minds. I'm done. It's your turn now.
Graham.
I wonder if Professor MacLeod could comment on a different form of disengagement rather than us becoming disengaged within our parishes, within our own limited interests, but the very definite movement of people out of mainstream denominations into other small groupings, and seeing the church in terms of a group which I would say introspective, but that's a value judgment, quite separate from the world, from other denominations, from anything else. And this seems to me a danger and way of thinking that's not uncommon in the church.
Well, I think I share that concern too, and the answer to it must be, I think, that our own church must have enough fellowship to make that unnecessary. Many churches are so limited in terms of interaction that people feel the need for a small, intimate group within the believing community itself. The Free Church in the North particularly has escaped that because it's always had an emphasis on informally getting together. And the only protection we have against that kind of secession, I think, is to maximise informal discourse and fellowship as much as we can. The charismatic movement in all its ramifications will make capital out of cold orthodoxy. And the answer is to warm the orthodoxy, not to abandon it. And I think that if we do give sufficient attention to it, you can ensure that your own local church has enough local interaction in small groups to make such a split off quite unnecessary. But it's an age of anti-institution, obviously, and people do want to be involved in the wrong sense often. They want to be talking themselves all the time. And it's probably burned up, too, with the James's ordinance, you know, don't all want to be teachers. There is a wrong passion towards involvement, where everybody wants to be in the driving seat of the church, and that's got to be controlled as well. Yes.
If we take the line that we should be heavily involved in the church in a wide basis, does that not lead to accentuating the fourth of your problems at the beginning, the diagnosis that so much of our energy can be drained by a compromised situation? How do we...
Well, I think in the short term that's inevitable, that you're going to work in tension with your colleagues and committees because you have a different universe of discourse and not come on ground very, very often. My hope is that you will be able to reform that situation and make it a more meaningful and more encouraging involvement. But I was also seeing that fourth point as maybe the nadir, the point where you are brought to conclude that the situation is hopeless, that the church itself, which should support you, is your biggest single problem. And my Professor Vincent had a marvellous answer to your kind of question, which I used already today, once I used it again as well, somewhere else. He said, consistency is the virtue of small minds. So I'm not being consistent all the time, and that's my defence on that one. Those principles are in some ways quite incompatible. If you want peace of mind, you can't edit a magazine as I do, because that drains your energy as well. But it seems to be part of the prophetic responsibility that you would have to be involved in the selection committee. Not all of you, but at least one or two of you should surely have access to something so crucial as that particular grouping. You tell me, used to. Are you the yes. boss? Nigel,
no, I don't think that's fair.
I think he should.
No, he won't know who's who. Nigel Cameron.
Who's Nigel Cameron?
That.
I did much appreciate what you had to say. I wonder whether, I don't know if this is fair, but in fact pushing you a little bit further on to ask for your perception of the likely future, or perhaps of the two possible futures. I mean, you know a good deal about us from the outside, and you know, as you were saying, a good deal more than I suspect many of those here do about them from the outside, as it were. And I wonder if you've turned your mind to how you see us 25, 30 years down the line.
I would hesitate to be too emphatic in replying to that, Nigel, because I think you must make your own history, and that you cannot predict it from where you stand just now, because, shall I say, we are irrational and we are human, and men will make events rather than events make the men. My hope is that you will very, very, very soon develop a high and aggressive profile, because you are a very, very numerous group and also a very talented group. And your potential for reform has never been higher. My view is, if you don't use it soon, it will be dissipated. And I would think that the next 2 years are critical, that if you don't make a bid soon to assert yourself, that things will not get better and better, but they will maybe get worse and worse, fall away from the current point. But I would rather challenge than predict in this area. It does not seem to me that secession is an option that many of you have meaningfully contemplated. I think it is there theoretically. But I think that the emotional cost of leaving a beloved and familiar establishment is very, very high. It would be for me as it is for you. And you'll only pay that price if you absolutely have to. And I think that those who run the church have their own ways of mollifying and pacifying to prevent the passion coming to that boiling point. And I think that the answer to the situation must be there are 200, 300 of you altogether, I imagine. And you have a coherent collective outlook on theology and polity. And I think that if you were to move aggressively now, that you have the chance to change direction, the church's whole direction, very, very emphatically.
David Searle.
Yes, David Searle is next.
I could make a couple of comments. The first one really is to take issue with you on what you just said. To a certain extent, I'm sorry that you quoted the situation in Wales in isolation, because I think the Welsh situation is really contaminated by a fair bit of nationalism there. One has only to look at the way in which the UCCF in Wales has done a UDI from the UCCF in Leicester, and I think less than honourably, for they're supported financially by Leicester, and yet they are very aggressive towards Leicester, and have brought in their nationalism into the UCCF, into the universities. Anyone who speaks there has to have a Welsh interpreter. And the movement in Wales, the evangelical movement in Wales, has, to my mind, and I have a little bit of experience of it, in its fragmented history, has got a fair bit of nationalism in it. And I would have thought that if you were going to quote that, you really, in fairness, to get a balanced picture, ought to quote the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. And I know you were over there about 3 years ago. And I wouldn't want the situation of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland to be dominated by the political situation there. 40 years ago, the Presbyterian Church in Ireland was very similar to the Church of Scotland, perhaps 20 years ago here, with only a few men who were Orthodox. And yet today there would be well over a 50% majority. And that they haven't, the evangelicals haven't forced a profile. They have worked on a policy very similar to the policy which is either articulated or unarticulated by Mr. Still, of quiet infiltration. And I would think by the end of the century they would have a complete control of the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. I don't know what my brethren would say, but certainly they are well ahead of the Church of Scotland. And I think in quoting the Welsh situation, one would see that one way that things could go. But I would have thought the Irish situation was a far better and more fruitful way that things should go. The second comment that I would like to make is one that I'm a little uneasy about your discipline. Now, I know this is still reinforced what you said about all of us wanting to make sure that born-again folk are admitted to the Lord's table, but you did quote Knox. And I think you would find it hard to substantiate Knox setting up a discipline which tried to guarantee or tried to prove or tried to demonstrate that those who came to the Lord's table were born again. I can't quote directly from the Book of Discipline, but it goes something like this. Intolerable we judge it that a person be admitted to the Lord's table not knowing wherein his righteousness consisteth. Mm-hmm. And that really is based on Calvin and his doctrine of the Church and the Institutes, as I understand it, that we can never be arbiters of those who are regenerate and those who are not regenerate, that all we can do is make sure that they understand. After all, in Knox's day, it was a very simple catechizing that was applied to those who came. And Bannerman, in his Church of Christ, makes this very clear that the Reformed Church has historically simply looked for a credible profession of faith. And it's been the Baptist churches and the Pietistic movement that's tried to look for evidences of faith. And so I would be uneasy about what you've said about discipline with regard to the Lord's table. And I think the strong parabolic teaching, the tares and the wheat, and within the epistles as well, which would indicate that the church will always be a mixed church with tares and wheat.
Well, I must draw a deep breath first before I start to reply to that. I think you misunderstand me probably on both counts. I quoted Wales because of the opposite intention of what you're referring to. I see Wales as a very bad model because they have seceded atomistically in ones and twos and triplets, and I deprecate that. The Welsh CUs, I know, live in tension with Leicester, but it's partly because of the commitment of the Welsh CUs to the doctrine of everlasting punishment in hell, which they found Leicester was not prepared to support or endorse to the same degree. And that led to tensions between them. But I have no patience at all with the Welsh nationalist perspective, which I myself have suffered from. And I haven't been to Wales for the last 8 or 9 years because of that particular factor. Now, I've been to Ireland, I suppose, 3 times in the last year, and I appreciate what you say about the Irish Presbyterian Church there. I would make 2 points, that it is suspected that there too they are now going over the hill, and that their influence is not quite what it was. And secondly, that they are also facing the woman's ordination issue at the moment in a fairly direct and crucial way. And it's causing them some of the same tensions as you experience back here in Scotland. I think that they were very aggressive, but they were very aggressive on a different issue. They were very aggressive on the ecumenical issue, which maybe is not all that important to us and doesn't affect me as much as it affects Irishmen as a rule. With regard to church discipline, I did try to emphasise that I didn't want to go back into a Highland or North American approach to this problem at all, where one became a church member after a narrative of conversion experience and you had to prove you were born again. I spoke simply of visible Christianity, and my concern was that we should bar from the Lord's table those who are guilty of scandalous behaviour, such as, for example, never attending church or attending church twice a year. Now, that doesn't require, in my view, any kind of special spiritual insight. It is simply a fact that there is an outward behaviour pattern which, in my judgment, contradicts the profession that is made. There are 3 possibilities of admission of the principles here. It may be an accredited profession, which is the Highland attitude, or it may be uncontradicted, which is maybe your attitude. And there is the credible one, which is my attitude, the middle position. And I'm thoroughly Bannermanian in this particular respect, that I would certainly not want any prying into people's private spiritual experience. I would simply want an outward life that is itself conformable with the gospel of Christ, that is not at all scandalous. And I would take it that all of us would agree that in Scotland today there are many members and elders whose outward conduct is not remotely credible as a Christian discipleship.
Andrew McGowan.
Can I take you back to what you said about secession? You suggested that evangelicals in the Church of Scotland have over the years said that if that happens we secede, and then perhaps drawing back. In print you've been a little more aggressive. You've said that we keep moving the goalposts.
Did I say that?
You also made a great deal this afternoon of this whole question of women's ordination. Now, if our friend Ian Wright
were to be deposed by the General Assembly, would that be an issue for wholesale ecclesiastical disobedience or secession, or would it not?
I'm not sure that's the best way of putting it, Andrew. I would need to ask, I suppose, are we all prepared, are any of us prepared, in fact, to disobey the Church on this matter, along with the NSC, the only one prepared to take that stand and say, no, I won't do this in any circumstances. If the Church says that you must do it, you have two options, either to resign or to express a collective defiance. In other words, present to the Assembly an overture that says, you know, this is our position, and we will not implement this particular directive from the Assembly at all. It does seem to me to be an issue of fundamental importance. I think Graham Leonard is right that this is a schismatic act to ordain women, that it does affect the question of authority in the Church of Scotland very, very directly. And it is my view that if you allow this issue to pass without taking a stand, it will destroy your credibility, and it will also, I think, shall I say, destroy your own spirituality, because it's going to affect your own consciences. You can't then go and get up and say in your local churches, I do this, but it's against my conscience. If it is, why are you doing it? You have to make up your minds, is it right or is it wrong? If it's wrong, we don't do it. And if they insist that we must, then it is intolerable. And we must protest and, I suppose, eventually resign. Unless you organise it, all of you will disobey the same year and all be thrown out the same year, which is rather difficult to organise.
Robert Calvin.
Professor MacLeod, I'd like to say thank you and amen, amen to many things you've said, but there's one thing that I feel sort of uncomfortable with. You talk straightly about being fundamentalist. Now, I do not think of myself as a fundamentalist. I could probably begin to start thinking about my pedigree at that point, but many people call me a fundamentalist. I do not think in those terms. And it seems to me that when you do start thinking about being a fundamentalist and what are the fundamentals of the faith, then the issue of what compromises those fundamentals, whether it be the virgin birth or the ordination of women, becomes a bigger issue. And I feel that if you're going to be thinking in these terms about being a fundamentalist and being concerned about issues that are going to compromise the fundamentals of the faith, then you become a very conscientious Christian, very conscientious minister. And I'm not sure that our consciences can dictate the movement, schism of ourselves in and out of the Church of Scotland upon a one thing that we do not see as the fundamental of the faith. I'm committed to Christ. Now, we all say that. I'm committed to certain fundamentals of the faith. But I'm not sure that there's much place for me being a very conscientious person in terms of other things that are no doubt related to the fundamentals of the faith.
Well, it is a very loaded word and not always a helpful word, of course, but I use it very much in its Mitch and Warfieldian sense that, I mean, there are Islamic fundamentalists and RC ones too, I'm told, and that is a completely different change of use in that particular term. A fundamentalist is a person who believes simply that certain doctrines are true and are essential to Christian faith. The difficulty is that we don't have in the Church at the moment any statement of such fundamentals. And that is an unprecedented situation in church history. I mean, the early church had a rule of faith, implicit or otherwise. We seem to have no rule of faith at the present time. Now, if your concern is with subjectivism, you know, who am I to judge what's fundamental and what's not, I accept that up to a point. But I think that in practice, all of us must have a persuasion that, for example, the deity of Christ is fundamental. And that justification by faith alone is fundamental. In fact, it can be argued that your own standards, Article 1, for example, insists on a Trinitarian formula, that doctrine at least is a fundamental part of your constitution. And that's, I think, Dr. Lyle's position, as the gentleman that Mr. Still referred to, that article... It's not subject to assembly manipulation or abandonment. It defines the church. The church is also Protestant in character by Act of Parliament. So there are two, I think, fairly fundamental points that we could insist on as what's non-negotiable. I certainly don't want us to end up in subjective decisions. My concern would be that we should have some movement of this kind, some group, that would itself work out for itself what is your list of fundamentals, which I would keep to a biblical minimum. In other words, there are certain doctrines of which the New Testament itself says that they are fundamental. So it isn't entirely subjective. The first things are that Christ died for our sins and rose again the third day. Justification by faith alone. If you preach some other gospel, then that's anathema. And one could compile from the New Testament a fairly extensive list of up to 20 points which it regards as non-negotiable. And we would say that if the church denies any of these, then it has ceased to bear witness to the gospel. But there is the complication that a church's position on doctrine can't be identified simply with its confession. A non-confessional church can have a pulpit ministry which is evangelical, and we can judge that church from its pulpit ministry. But I wouldn't allow that it is difficult to know what the fundamentals are. I think it is fairly easy to gather them from the New Testament.
Sounded sure.
If you were to defend the men who wanted to sing something other than the Psalms and won, what would you then do in your church, remembering what you said to us this afternoon? What would your next point be on that issue?
Well, these men would be under threat of deposition, and I would feel then bound to defend them, because I would tend to share their convictions personally, and also would feel bound to assert their liberty to hold what they do hold. And I don't see that as a particularly complicated chess game at all, because in a way there is no next move in this one. The next move is that they stay in the church. They're not ejected. There really is no progress beyond that. They have established that it is within our constitution to sing something other than Psalms only. And they are at liberty to conduct worship according to their own newfound freedom. At the moment, my position on that has been that it is not worth putting the church on. But if other brethren push it more aggressively and are disciplined for it, then I can't stand by and watch them made into martyrs. I'd have to get involved myself and stand with them. And if we won our case, we would then be exploding the whole principle of exclusive psalmody and allowing local churches to conduct worship in a different way. But you're thinking along different lines, I think.
I'm thinking along the ordination of women. I'm wanting to know theoretically what your position would be on the matter you raised to help us if we say no, we find it again our conscience.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's helpful to that clarification. My view on that again is that you must act collectively as far as possible, and that after the said faithful assembly, you should meet as a group and discuss as a group where to go. And that the options are to continue your separate existence as a vestigial Creef Brotherhood, shall we say, metamorphosed into an ecclesia denomination. Do you continue that existence, or do you look for some other partner with whom you could link? And that might then lead to an approach to, say, the Free Church, which would put us under obligation to explore with you the putative basis of a new alignment. In other words, you might say to us, we'll join you simplicitor on the basis of your current constitution, or we'll join you on the basis of our renegotiated constitution. Will you talk to us? And I'm quite happy to meet you on either of those fronts.
Peter White.
We are grateful to you, I'm sure. There is one premise which I don't think is true, Professor McLeod, and it certainly is important on the matter that has become the major discussion point, the ordination of women. You said, and I think I wrote it down right, you have a coherent collective attitude on theology and polity. I don't read us that way. And that gives me a very great deal of thought as I contemplate a soon-to-come General Assembly. And I therefore ask whether you, if my premise is more correct than yours, whether you think that modifies in any way where one goes at such a time.
Well, it certainly complicates it. And you'd have to ask, really, do you work out a coherent policy? In other words, if you have differing views in the Brotherhood, do you discuss it and vote upon it and have a collective attitude on it? And everybody will behave in terms of group loyalty, like a cabinet decision. Or you can decide that you will ignore the Brotherhood and simply vote individually. And I would regard that as basically fairly unfortunate. But still, you have this other problem that we are thinking almost Kabbalistically of the Ecclesia Ola in Ecclesia. And that always disturbs me. But that is an anomaly arising from the anomaly of a church which needs reformation. That you have to find fellowship not in the church itself, but within a Brotherhood within the church itself, and that complicates life considerably. I do want to, if I keep on this particular point, you have to think of possible options beyond the assemblies. You've got to think of the assembly itself too. Do we thrash out a collective attitude of the assembly? That's the first point. Suppose it goes against us, what do we do then? And I sort of feel at once that the thought of linking up with the Free Church is pretty unthinkable, which I find in itself very, very interesting. Basically because my suspicion is that you would find our form of worship so unacceptable. But you didn't find woman elders unacceptable. So which inconvenience do you choose? Which is the worst inconvenience? But let me say that I have made public my own position on this, that I would be very happy to discuss the possibility of a completely new alignment with a new confession of faith on which we could link, unite most of Scotland's evangelicals or Presbyterian persuasion.
Two more questions, and they're going to be asked by William Neal and then Ian Hamilton.
Thank you. If we think of the 1843 situation, I wonder if the ministers who were at the crucial 1843 assembly mm-hmm. were able to look around at the elders who were at it and know that all these elders were right behind them, mm-hmm. the ministers who knew that they were going to have to leave. I wonder if these ministers, picturing their congregation on a Sunday, knew that if they left, a great number of their people would go with them. I'd be interested to know what people thought about that. As I think of the situation today, there are many, many evangelical men who are very loved by their people mm. in the Church of Scotland. We know we're loved, but a lot of the basis of that love is the manifest love that we have for them. And I don't sense that there's this really profound love of the Lord that would bring masses of the people with us.
Yes.
I think we would go and we'd look behind us.
And there wouldn't be
we'd
there.
We'd see nothing but dog collars. I don't like a dog collar either. I'd maybe put one on for that occasion. But I don't know if we'd have enough of the people with us for it to be anything other than a quixotic gesture
yes.
into the wilderness.
Well, I think that must be pondered very carefully. They had had the convocation, of course, in 1842 and 1843 before the disruption took place. And they knew to a fair degree of accuracy the number of clergy who would take the step if called upon. But they were still overwhelmed by the response of the clergy. I mean, far more left than anybody expected would ever leave. It wasn't entirely a good thing in other directions. They were also amazed by the number of people who left. But the difference, I think, was, Mr. Neil, compared to your situation, that they held the people's consciences because the people knew the issues. I mean, these men had preached on the church, on ecclesiology, on Presbyterian polity, on church-state relationships. Now, to us, to you, that sounds very unspiritual. Have you ever preached on Presbyterian polity? And only if you have their consciences as well as their emotions can you expect them to actually follow you into the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And I do really hope that we'll take my point seriously, that we want to persuade our people too. And if we secede, if that's forced upon us, that we would secede as churches, not simply as clergy. Because let me say, as a free churchman, that we have had a lot of problems with the fact that we're a very easy option for ministers who have no churches. And we can get a situation where we have plenty clerics and no congregations for them, and that's no use to us. We want the people as well. let that be known.
Now, the last question, Ian Howell.
Perhaps it was inevitable that our discussion should have gravitated in the direction that it has done, given what Professor McLeod has been saying to us, and I'm sure we've all been challenged by. But I'd be concerned that we didn't miss the challenge of the first half of Professor McLeod's paper.
Yeah, yeah.
Which seems to me to be challenging us to ask ourselves whether we really are exercising a gospel ministry towards those who are admitted into the fellowship of the church at baptism, who are admitted by profession of faith, and who are brought into the oversight and leadership of the church through the diaconate and kirk session. I think David Searle raised a very important point when he talked about the whole issue of credible profession. And I think it's right that in our tradition we have not sought to scrutinise, we might say, the souls of people who come forward for baptism and membership, but perhaps we have been too lax in accepting verbal confessions of orthodoxy rather than credible professions of verbal orthodoxy. And we thought that our great need is, yes, let's look to the future and let's be wise and thoughtful and discerning as to what may happen. but let's at the same time be equally passionate about doing all that is within our grasp to do to ensure that those who come forward for covenant baptism and those who come forward to identify themselves with the fellowship of the church and those who are proposed as elders in the Church of God are people whose lives evidently commend the gospel, evidently, however poorly, commend the reality of the gospel. And in that way, our churches slowly but surely begin to take shape. I'm sure I speak for many of us when I speak of the pressures we feel when people come forward, children of many of us who come every Sunday, or people who are proposed for leadership in the church, and we think, goodness, how am I going to cope if I stand up and say that such and such is never at an evening service, never at prayer, when I speak to him seems clueless about the essentials of saving grace and faith in the vicarious atonement of our Lord Jesus Christ. I just hope the challenge of that has not been lost, because it seems to me that that, if we laid hold of it and took it to heart, could bear great fruit in terms of our future as a brotherhood or whatever else we might develop into.
No.
Yes. I just want to close by saying again how grateful we are to you for, I don't know, perhaps some of those who've read you and perhaps haven't heard you or don't know you and received a different impression of you today, in a very, very pleasing one indeed. I'm very much impressed with this, if I may, just before we close, I think we'll close by saying the benediction together, because time's gone. I'm very much impressed with this that you wrote about the Lord Chancellor. May I read this paragraph? I think it's beautiful. The Lord Chancellor is part of a political system which involves constant public association with representatives of all kinds of faith. He has to work within the framework of the possible. That is not a concession to cynicism. The principle of accommodation is central to biblical and Calvinist thought. That's a sentence, isn't it? And it could be applied to other things. God's revelation had to accommodate itself to the hardness of people's heart, and even a free Presbyterian Lord Chancellor has to do the same. He cannot wave a wand and present us with totally biblical legislation on divorce, abortion, and Sunday trading. Lord Chancellor, though he is, he stands with Christ on the garbage heap. That's good. Opposed by the world because he is a Christian, and opposed by Christians because he refuses to surrender to a presbytery the freedom with which Christ made him free. Thank you for that. Let's stand and say the benediction together.